Please sit comfortably. So good morning, everyone. To this one day, it's such a delightful experience during the work period to see everyone going around doing their different tasks and cooking food and cleaning up and sweeping and mowing the lawns. And it connects into the title of this talk today, which is a very well-known koan, which you've probably heard of before and I've spoken of before, Rinzai's true person of no rank. So when we do work period, we have no rank. Doesn't matter who we are in our everyday life. We just sweep the weeds, mow the lawns, cook, wash up, just do all those tasks 100%, not caught in any identity. So, to remind you of this koan, Rinzai instructed his assembly, "There is one true person of no rank, always coming out and going through the gates of your face," meaning your senses, eyes, ears, nose. "Beginners who have not yet witnessed that, look, look." Then a monk came out and asked, "What is the one true person of no rank?" Rinzai descended for the rostrum and grabbed him. The monk hesitated. Rinzai pushed him away and said, "The true person of no rank, what a shit stick you are." True Rinzai style. No sweetness and light anywhere. It's a great koan. If we look at the actual nature of the koan, so Rinzai throws out this challenge, who is the true person of no rank, who's beyond concepts of high and low, etc., enlightened, not enlightened. And then a monk comes forward. Now, this was a very courageous monk that came forward, particularly in front of such a tiger of a teacher, So we must admire his courage for coming forward and asking the question. So then he asks his question, what is the one true person of no rank? So Rinzai descends from the rostrum and then grabs him. And then as the koan goes on, the monk hesitates. There's the problem. The monk hesitates. What do we do when we hesitate, when we're challenged and we hesitate? We start thinking, what do I do now? Who am I? All of that. And it's because of the hesitation that Rinzai sees he's caught up in thinking about something, about what to do. And then he gives his admonishment. This true person of no rank, what a shit stick you are, Gives him something, a bit of stick to keep working on his issues, keep him going, a bit like Mu, the koan Mu. But what would you do? If you were the monk who came forward and then the teacher comes down and grabs you by the lapel, you could push him back. Or you could go, gee, the Roshi's hand must be really hurting grabbing me so hard. It's white knuckling it. A lot of things you could do which are just in the moment ordinary responses. That's perhaps how you could respond to that challenge. But let's look at this koan in the context of probably, I think Rinzai was around 6th or 7th century AD or BC, a very long time ago in Confucian China anyway. And we'll look at it in the context of living in Australia in the 21st century, because we live in a very different culture to the culture that existed back then, which is a Confucian culture. And in a Confucian culture, as you know, there's a high respect for the elders, for authority, and very different to our culture. There's not the same status being put on an individual. You sacrifice your individuality for the good of the whole. And that's the kind of community that you're living in. And within that, characteristic of Confucian culture then, and perhaps even today, is that there's all these rules and regulations about how you had to behave towards those who are above you and those who are below you and those who are co-equal to you. So a whole labyrinth of rules and obligations and mutual obligations, and the individual was kind of lost in the prison, you know, of all of those different sort of obligations, moral obligations and everything that they were entangled up in. It was like a web. And so Zen Buddhism was very, very refreshing, was kind of like a counterculture to that that web of tanglement that came with social obligations, to try to see into, in a sense, to be the individual. That was their challenge in that society, to find that individuality within that entanglement of obligation. And that's perhaps why it comes across to us as being very iconoclastic. You know, statements that we perhaps first read about, seen when we read Zen books about when you say the word Buddha, wash your mouth out with soap, you know, or the story of the monk who burns the wooden Buddha statue to warm himself by the fire. Mm-hmm. They seem very iconoclastic, anti-authoritarian. But Zen arose out of that Confucian culture as a way of the individual trying to liberate themselves from all of this conceptual overlay of high and low, etc. Mm-hmm. But when you look at Zen within our culture now in the 21st century in Australia and in the USA, say in particular, that has a different tradition, instead of us worshipping authority and elders, in a way, we're not nonconformist, really. We conform to worshipping the individual, and we conform to anti-authoritarianism, and we conform to disrespect of institutions and authority, which is a kind of a different type of conformism, in a way. And but when, like, in the early days of Zen coming to the West, that I was kind of involved in, like 60s and 70s and so on, one of the great attractions of it was this sense that it was anti-authoritarian, you know, and there was the beat poets like Gary Snyder and Ginsberg and the Dharma Bums, and it was all kind of loose and hippie, and Zen seemed very, very cool, you know. So it fitted in with our idea of this kind of Buddhism that was anti-Buddhism and anti-institution. And yet the big shock was, when you went to Japan to study Zen, you found that it was actually, through the eyes of the Japanese, an extremely conservative institution, ultra-conservative institution. And so what you thought it was from growing up in the West and the books you read about was very, very different from the, it was still sort of still very Confucian in its context. So that was a kind of surprise to experience that. But what happens now in our culture, some of the defining aspects of our culture, is there's two kind of races going on. Like there's a race to the bottom to be a victim, and there's the race to the top to be the best or having the most wonderful, exciting experience in life. And both of them are going on. Now, it is true that human beings are victimised by other people, but it's probably true to say that we're all victimisers as well as victims, because we're all driven by greed, hatred and ignorance, and if we are, we're going to harm other people through our actions, and then the harm is done back to us as well. So there are people who experience victimisation, but the problem becomes when you create a solid identity out of it. And then you can only see yourself as a victim. You don't ever question how you might victimize others. It's just solid. And then there's this other pattern in our culture which comes through advertising a lot, you know. And advertising is a very, very powerful influence in our culture. And so advertising is us kind of looking in the mirror. Because the people who do all the research into advertising, they find out, what can we get you to think about yourself and about this product so you'll buy it? That's all they're interested in, and the profit. And so they dish up all this stuff. If you have that car or that house or you go on that holiday, how amazing you're going to be. And we buy it. We all buy it. Advertising works. And so advertising is a kind of a mirror we look into as the kind of culture that we are. On social media, on Facebook, Instagram, people are trying to show to the world what an amazing life I have. What an amazing relationship I have, family, etc., etc. So everything is kind of exaggerated. And you see it in the language we use and the body language. Everything's awesome and amazing. Every book that comes out is awesome and amazing. Every film that comes out. Every experience I have. So we're caught in this. It's a different kind of delusion, conceptual delusion, that we're caught in than perhaps what people experienced in Confucian China. But nevertheless, it's a delusion, and it's still caught within these general concepts of better and worse and high and low. Whenever one human being ever meets another human being, there's three things going on socially. First one is you could call the in and out concept. So it's kind of like, are you of the same tribe as me or you're not the same tribe as me? You're a white man or you're an Asian man or a black man or whatever. There's something tribal going on. You like me or you're not like me. So that's going on. And then there's the high and low dimension. So where are we in status? Who is the highest and who is the lowest? Or are we co-equal? Right, that may be the other one as well. And then there's another dimension, which is the near-far dimension. So how close or distant are we? How intimate are we or not? Can we show signs of intimacy to one another? Or do we hug each other or we shake hands or we nod or whatever it is we do? So all of those three dimensions are in play when we say hello to another human being. And they all go on. All of those are just natural things which are wired into us. The problem is whether we attach to those ideas or not. There is an in and out dimension. There is a high and low dimension. There is a near and far dimension. That's going on socially, and we require social intelligence to understand that and how to respond. But Rinzai, like he did centuries ago, as Rinzai speaks to us today, he's still challenging us to see there's another way of experiencing our life and the way that we relate to other people that is outside of all of these dimensions. There's no in or out, there's no high or low, there's no near or far. There is just ordinary experience. It says the true person of no rank is that person who's coming in and out of his senses all the time. The one who just sees, the one who just hears, the one who just smells the rose or the garbage. The one who just walks, the one who just eats, who's not attached to identity. That one. That one, don't you? coming in and out of our senses all the time. That's the person of no rank. Mm-hmm. And as he said, that is going on all the time, and yet we put this conceptual, deluded overlay of status and so on everything that we do. Mm-hmm. So, this person of no rank, who is he or she or they? Mm-hmm. That's what we come back to. It comes back to what the spirit of the ordinary mind, Zen school, is, ordinary mind. Mm-hmm. Just this, just that, without attaching to identity. And then what happens is that when people understand the ordinariness of life and they become enlightened, they then get called names, like in India, you become a rishi. So a rishi is a person who's enlightened, then they become high in rank, you know, and then everyone worships them. And then you become a maharishi, right? So a great person of ordinariness, you know, and then you put on a pedestal, right? So it just goes on and on and on. The delusion goes on and on and on. And it's our challenge to see through this. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the Heart Sutra, and the Heart Sutra negates everything in Buddhism, you know, no path, no wisdom, no attainment. You could add to that, really, which might sound shocking in today's culture, no worth. Have no worth. Uh-huh. I have no worth. Being unworthy or worthless. Just other sort of conceptual frameworks of high or low, better or worse. If you do this practice, you don't go around, you don't somehow, in one sense, yes, psychologically, you would shift from perhaps feeling worthless to worthy, right? But it's not because you've gained anything. It's because you've lost something. You're just outside the whole dualism of the better or worse. Mm-hmm. And if you experience yourself in life as having no worth, then it doesn't really matter what other people think about you. It doesn't matter anymore. We're all so caught up at one level in what other people think about us. We might glibly say, oh, we don't care, but to one degree or another we do. Mm-hmm. But if you really see into that you have no worth, it's like you had, Bodhidharma had, didn't know who he was, had no merit. Mm-hmm. There's no wisdom, no attainment, nothing to gain. That's where you'll find your true freedom. Mm-hmm. That's where you find your true freedom. So, my advice to end on is, if you're 5'2", be a 5'2" Buddha. And if you're 6'8", be a 6'8" Buddha. Thank you.